Hello and welcome to Cobblecast. This is Ruh Yacoubi. Cobblecast is brought to you by Cobble Now, cobblenow.com, to tell Afghanistan stories to the world. Because Afghanistan matters and the stories of its people matter. Our guest in this episode is Damon Wilson, the President and Chief Executive of the National Endowment for Democracy, NED. NED is a private non-profit organization based in Washington. It was established in 1983 with the goal of promoting democracy and supporting democratic institutions around the world. Essentially, what NED does is it provides funding and resources to non-governmental organizations, civil society groups, and individuals who work to advance democratic principles, human rights, and rule of law in their respective countries. And I found my discussion with Damon Wilson quite interesting. He's very methodical in the way he thinks about issues. And that applies pretty much to Afghanistan as well. And I do hope that you will find it interesting and it will give you ideas about how to look at the country, about the prospects for its future, and at how can it be changed, or how can change come about, and who can change the country. That's a crucial problem. Who can change Afghanistan for its future, or who can write the next chapter in Afghanistan's history? Because for a lot of people, they've been quite restless in seeing Afghanistan under control of the Taliban. They want a quick fix, get the Taliban out, put something in its place. But I think in the real world, things do not move the way we always want them to move. What I found interesting about Damon's thoughts is that he sees Afghanistan as a long-term issue, something that the people of Afghanistan will have to change the country for themselves. And him and his organizations, as he said, is committed to helping the people who will bring about that change. And I do hope, again, that you will find this interview interesting. And also, it gives you ideas of your own. And please do share them with me. Damon, thank you so much for Cobblecasting with us today. I'm so grateful for your time. So thank you and welcome to Cobblecast.
Well, thank you so much. It is a pleasure to be with you and I'm honored to be on your show.
Thank you so much. And I just want to start this conversation with who's Damon Wilson. Do you class yourself as a foreign policy geek?
Sure. Basically, I love the world.
Yeah.
I've loved learning about the world since I was a small kid. And I grew up in the American South, spent part of my time in rural North Carolina. And from a very young age, when a young kid in third grade from whose family was chased out of Nicolae Ceaușescu's Romania, became my good friend, just kind of seeing that in a small community in North Carolina, gaining a little bit of perspective on what it meant to actually be free, not really understanding the concepts of tyranny, but seeing kind of what it meant for my friend in high school, a Baha'i family from Iran, one of my closest friends in high school. These really just, it fueled my interest in the world. And so whether it's foreign policy, foreign languages, culture, history, you know, I'm obsessed with learning and knowing about other countries and pretty much the people and really enamored by sort of people from such disparate backgrounds who all crave a sense of dignity, a sense of ability to influence their own life.
So you'd put yourself more of a people geek rather than foreign policy geek.
Put it that way. Yeah. For me, it's about understanding the culture, the history, the background, the context, the experiences that people are living through, whether it's in conflict or not. And so, yes, I'm interested in foreign policy and international politics and all that. But I think to actually understand international policy or politics or foreign policy, you need to have an appreciation of culture, of language, history. And And I am a student of the world. It's one of the reasons I love the endowment. Have to learn every day about challenges and opportunities in countries around the world.
Oh, thank you so much. And I think for a lot of people, when you talk to them, they usually have a defining moment in their life, whether it happens in the childhood or long after that. When it comes to, I mean, you've worked for NATO, you've worked for the State Department, you've been a diplomat, you've been a think tanker, as they would say. You've worked all over the place in Eastern Europe, in the Middle East. Growing up, was there a moment that you thought, that is a place that I want to be? This is that matters.
Well, even as a student, a young person, whether it was Central America or Afghanistan, certainly an arms race with the Soviets, these were issues that sort of obsessed me as a student, as a child, and really fueled my interest in getting to know the world. And so I didn't come from a family that traveled a lot or had the means to spend family vacations overseas. It just wasn't wasn't who we were. And so it wasn't until I went to university, to Duke, where I was able to really find opportunities where people would help fund me to go overseas. And my experiences still at a young age of spending the first time living in a foreign country in Estonia, in the Baltic states, during their first year of independence, doing summer intern projects, working with refugee programs in the Balkans during the wars, a first job out of college with Save the Children of Rwanda. Those were really formative experiences that kind of showed me both the opportunity. You know, I was beginning my career on the wave of the third wave of democratization. We had seen democratization spread across the developing world and then the collapse of the Berlin Wall. Man, I was in the thick of it, traveling and living and working and studying Central Eastern Europe, Ukraine, all of that. But I also saw the dark side pretty quickly. I saw the dark side in the Balkans, Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait, and then headed to Rwanda right after the genocide. And so it was really a moment of contrast where it felt like opportunity, democracy's ascendance, and yet seeing some of the dark side that came not from what was often popularly perceived as, you know, ethnic tensions and ancient hatreds, but seeing up close that it was really individuals craving power, manipulating others, using cleavages in society for their own glory, their own power, their own greed. It was really enlightening to me at that stage to have an appreciation of what was really important to human dignity in the world.
You just mentioned democracy being on the ascendancy, and now we've had democracies regressing. You've left the full circle of democracy being on top and then democracy being in doubt. And now we've had a period of democracy being on the back foot. Given your job, as I can see the emblem very clearly behind you, freedom around the world, and democracies being on the back foot means freedoms being curtailed, people losing their rights and their dignities. Nowhere it is more pronounced than it is in Afghanistan. Of course, you know, there are so many flashpoints around the world, from Ukraine to Sudan to the Middle East to Iran to all different parts of the world. What I want to do is just to spin back a bit and to, when did Afghanistan first register in your consciousness? You were working with Lord Robertson in NATO during 9/11, or was
that's
it
right.
after? Yeah, and
sure.
And for a lot of people, Afghanistan came to their consciousness in the West with 9/11.
That's right. I mean, look, you're right that the formative moment was 9/11. Now, Afghanistan had come to my consciousness well before that, Soviet invasion, the struggle of the country, and the role that the United States was focused on at the time, the arrival of the Taliban. When I worked in Rwanda, I was working with Save the Children, and I had an opportunity to continue on with Save the Children. And the idea was to head to Tajikistan and Afghanistan. And this was right when the Taliban, early on, and we were already getting an indication of real challenges to girls in schools.
Yeah.
And I ended up going back to Princeton, going back to graduate school instead of heading to Afghanistan in the early years of the Taliban. And it always nagged on me that the challenges that I felt and the experience of working on the ground in countries, it's been so much more of an education than any education I've gotten at school. But I always had a tinge of maybe I should have gone to Afghanistan then and pushed off Princeton another year or two.
Mm.
And so Afghanistan had really been present in my mindset. And when 9/11 happened and I was working at NATO,
yeah,
I stepped to the fore with Lord Robertson and said, you know, I was one of his deputy chiefs of staff, essentially.
Yeah.
That I want to lead on this issue for him. And so I was able to be his staffer, his lead staffer on 9/11, our response, Afghanistan. And it really was an extraordinary experience, not just the alliance's response and being part of that response, invoking Article 5, an attack on one is an attack on all for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
But I think more importantly, both the diplomacy of working with the United States, frankly, mm-hmm. and other allies, to increase their willingness to be committed to Afghanistan for the long haul. It was very much a part of the home game diplomacy.
Yeah.
But at the same time, understanding that NATO was ill prepared for this task. And so part of what I was able to work on was how to help take a operational headquarters of the alliance and having major learning opportunity, strategy sessions, conferences, academics, activists, and really put NATO headquarters, NATO defense planners and policy people through sort of deep dive sessions that began what would become a long-term commitment of NATO officials having a familiarity mm-hmm. with Afghanistan's culture, its history, its background, its context. And that was really when I got to dig my own teeth into the issue. And it's a country, a place, a people that are close to my heart, in part because of that. Really, we'll get to it, but in part because of Ned's commitment to Afghanistan.
Fast forward back to 2021, almost two decades after. How did it feel for you to watch those images? Out of Kabul, people fleeing for their lives, people falling off planes, and you know the days that followed, and of course days before that, you being at NED, you know, such an important institution when it comes to promoting democracy and freedom around the world, being at the center of it, looking from afar on a country where all the things that you just mentioned, Operation Enduring Freedom, promised a lot of freedoms to the people of Afghanistan, whatever the objectives of the war initially, but there was a system put in place, whatever flawed it was, but it all came crashing down as the world watched and as the people of Afghanistan suffered. As somebody who's so deeply involved into it, and how did it emotionally feel, not just on practical political aspect?
Ro, I'd answer that with sort of two responses. The first was one of feeling the sense of horror, it's horrific, disgrace, shame. The second feeling was one of resolve, determination, and commitment. And I felt very strongly that the endowment, being an independent organization, so we're not subject to U.S. government policy, but we're based in Washington. We're funded by the American people through Congress. We're, mm-hmm. we're an American-facing entity. That I felt that it was really important that we stay true to who we are at the endowment, represent the best of the values of the American people, and make a rock-solid commitment to Afghanistan's Democrats, to Afghanistan's future, to stand by so many Afghans that built a remarkably diverse, pluralistic, vibrant, open society, democratic society, and incredible, as you well know, incredible human capacity in the media space. I mean, it's just remarkable. And that there were so many democratic gains by the people of Afghanistan that I felt really shame for what was happening and my own country's role in all of that. But an absolute determination to do what Ned does best, and in tough times, to stand by our partners and to stand by the long-term commitment of democracy and freedom in Afghanistan, a place where the endowment had provided support under very difficult circumstances when the Taliban first ruled the country. And I was 100% committed that we would be standing by the Afghan people's side going forward. And so those really mixed emotions sort of drove each other. Horror, fueling our determination, knowing that what we were experiencing, it meant nothing. It was nothing compared to what the people of Afghanistan were experiencing, what they were losing. And the best, our job is a job of support. And so I felt that very early in my tenure here, Kabul fell 3 weeks after I started, 3 weeks into this job, not even knowing exactly all my job. I knew that part of my purpose, part of my mission had to be ensure that our institution did right by our own mission and by the Afghan people at a time when so many were not done right.
You know, those days, the damage that it did to the people of Afghanistan is one side, but the damage that it did to the Western liberal democratic institutions and their claims of solidarity, I think it was profound as well. We saw the British Defense Secretary crying live on air. We had parliamentarians, Tom Tugendhat, for example, in the British Parliament, a former soldier. I think his was one of the most memorable speeches in British Parliament's recent history about how he felt being defeated. It was a choice by the West to be defeated rather than being forced out of the country. I was talking to a senior British politician recently, and we talked about Afghanistan, what it's going to look like, given the West, the Ukraine preoccupation, and also all the things going around. And why hasn't there been some sort of postmortem when it comes to really debating Afghanistan as to what went wrong, why we did what we did, why didn't we persevere, knowing that it was not costing a lot of resources to create that necessary stalemate in the country to ensure that the gains of the people of Afghanistan are protected by showing that commitment that they needed. But the response was that the reason we cannot talk about Afghanistan, A, as you just mentioned, we are really deeply embarrassed, and B, it's become a poison chalice. We don't want to touch it anymore because we've been tarnished by it. And the only way that we can, I suppose, rebrand ourselves as in having the resolve to fight is to demonstrate it in Ukraine. Do you see that? Do you feel that analysis?
Look, from the moment this was happening, I felt that the handling of Afghanistan was going to be a bit of a stain on my own country and on our conscience. But it also was a realization for me in my role at the endowment that it sounds a little bit perverse to say an opportunity, but I have confidence in the Afghan people and the future of Afghanistan, knowing that I'm not naive about this. I understand the situation. I understand the Taliban's control. I understand the gender apartheid. I understand the pain that many of those that we supported have felt. But I also have seen over and over again the experience that people have. You don't put that back in a box. You don't close people's minds so easily. You can exert more and more resources to control people, to intimidate people, to coerce people. But often these experiences provide a foundation for the next chapter, and a foundation that might be a little bit more of a solid foundation to build a future chapter on. And so that's where my headspace is. I wasn't responsible for U.S. policy. I'm not responsible for U.S. policy today. But I am responsible for stewarding America's foundation for freedom. And the endowments approach is one of support. In fact, it's the exact opposite of democracy at the barrel of a gun. Mm-hmm. It's just not Ned. Ned is about how do we find those democratic actors who are in their own struggle and give them oxygen for their struggle, their agenda to shape the future of their country. And so my head is squarely in that space of how do we continue to support Afghans in the country and in the diaspora, now in exile, who are going to be part of building the foundation mm-hmm. for a future chapter. And the way I think about it is a future chapter that I hope can be more sustainable because it won't be something that is the product of a military intervention, won't be something that's the product of outside powers manipulating and pushing for this. But can it be really something that is grounded, authentic, and based in Afghans determining their own future? I'm not Pollyannish. I'm not naive. This doesn't happen tomorrow. Mm-hmm. But Ned has basically been supportive of this cause in Afghanistan for almost four decades. We are not fair weather friends. Mm-hmm. And I bring to this role that perspective that we're going to stay consistent in our support. And this next chapter one day will be built by Afghans themselves. And therefore, I think it will be more durable, more sustainable, and it's going to look different. And it's hard to even imagine that today, but I know enough Afghans who believe in that, who are working towards that, that we owe it to them to say, we're going to stand with you in your journey. We're going to provide support for that. It is your struggle. So it's been a bittersweet moment, super painful for so many involved. Mm-hmm. It is embarrassing for many Western powers. But how can this restore the agency of Afghans themselves? And I don't know exactly what that's going to look like. I don't see a linear path forward.
But I see your perspective quite interesting in many ways, that this next chapter in Afghanistan, and I've always argued that we've got this sense, unfortunately, in some places in the West where it's a done deal from day one. You know, it was an argument that made from day one. Afghanistan has been won by the Taliban. It's done deal. We have to accept them as they are. And they're the realities of that country, as one of senior British military figures say, the country boys. Those type of words were being used as to show that they're the indigenous people of Afghanistan, the real fabric of that society. Anything that they do is what that people are. That can only be changed either by force, or it's going to take us centuries for that community of people to evolve. But what I see from your point of view, so Ned will try to help the people of Afghanistan, empower them to change the country bottom up. It's a grassroots movement, create a grassroots movement of ideas, of people, to change the mindset, hopefully bring about that change that the people of Afghanistan so desperately need. But the challenge that you have and the challenge that we all have is that disparate group of people that were pushed out of Afghanistan, so many talents, and Afghanistan just overnight becomes so empty of so much talent, of so much. It's quite painful to describe how much was lost in one couple of weeks. And now all those human capitals outside the country. And I just want to pick your brain into how best can Ned support these people who've got their own different ideas, their own sense of what it means to be a citizen of the world, I suppose. Many of them are figuring it out for themselves, as you'd imagine how disorientating it is to build a new life. And you're in touch with them in America, and I'm in touch with them in Britain, in Europe, about people trying to rebuild their own lives to. For a lot of people, it's still confusing. They've not really come to terms with what really happened to them. And so what I wanted to, in a sense, ask you was, what practical steps do you think Ned is taking and Ned's need to take to empower people both inside Afghanistan to make sure that they know there is a group of people who will stand by them no matter what? And also those who are outside Afghanistan, they say, okay, this is a fresh world. We can play our part, given the right support.
Well, first of all, the premise of all of this is that Afghans have already changed Afghanistan. The Taliban are back in power, but this is not 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. You don't put people's minds back in a box. The experiences they've had, the exposure they've had, the Taliban are going to have to struggle with governing a different country, a different people. And we see that manifesting around the country. But the practical things that we've been focused on, first, it was support for as many of our partners we could in the immediate phase that felt for their safety and security that they had to get out.
Mm-hmm.
And to really manage, exceptionally in Ned's history, manage our own evacuation for our own people. Because, of course, the people we support don't work for the U.S. government. They yeah. worked for Afghanistan. They worked for independent institutions, independent media, civil society. Thank goodness they did. But they weren't working for the U.S. military. And so they didn't have the same access to the evacuation that those who were working directly for the U.S. government did. And so that was our first priority, recognizing that this incredible group of people were going to potentially be left behind. How could we support our partners directly? Second is to help those who did leave to figure out, you got to get on your feet. You got to figure out how to take care of your family. You've mm-hmm. gone through a lot of trauma. We don't want to pull the carpet out from under people when they're going through that type of transition. We want to stand by their side to see who are those that are going to adapt and living in exile, but still be relevant to the future of Afghanistan, and others that are going to end up having to figure out a different career path, different role for their life. We see this in the diaspora groups all around the world and here in the United States often.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a time of transition, where yeah. we want to stand by people to figure out, as they figure out their way forward. But I think most importantly for me, and what I told our team, even as we were focused like a laser on the evacuation, remember that our priority will be to stand by the Afghan people themselves and their struggle, particularly inside Afghanistan. And I disagree with you a little bit. Yes, you're right that an incredible amount of human capital left the country, incredibly talented people. It's part of the reason why I have a sense of optimism mm-hmm. about the future of Afghanistan, because you see such remarkable talent. It's really, really quite stunning. And it's what makes this really painful.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's very easy. The country's not emptied out. Mm-hmm. There are amazing people and resources that remain inside Afghanistan. There is incredible activism still taking place. There is amazing organizing among women's groups. Ned itself still has new organizations coming to the endowment seeking mm-hmm. support in today's Afghanistan. And I think ultimately, whether you're in the diaspora or whether you're like Ned, they need to be our focus. How are those on the ground? How are we best positioned to support them and their struggle, knowing that the rules of the game have changed, knowing that they've got to stay safe, knowing that there's only a certain amount of civic space to operate in? But letting people on the ground determine what they can do, what they want to do, and standing by their side to send, as you say, an unequivocal message of moral support.
Mm-hmm.
We're with you in this journey. It can be difficult, but we are not turning our back on mm-hmm. the people of Afghanistan or the idea of a free, democratic Afghanistan one day. It can sound a little bit naive to say that, but we're all in, whether it's in 3 years or 30 years. We're going to be in this cause and follow and be there as the Afghans help shape that future.
One of the challenges that for people who've either left Afghanistan or those who've remained in Afghanistan is to keep the subject relevant to policymakers around the world. And as I said earlier, many policymakers or politicians are quite embarrassed to talk about Afghanistan. They'd rather talk about something that makes people feel good about themselves rather than makes people feel bad. That's in the nature of politics. How could you help to keep Afghanistan relevant, given all the competing agendas on the Western political minds? And right. When we talk about freedom, democracy, etc., you know, human dignity, we're not expecting President Xi Jinping to spring up to action. We're not demanding attention from Putin or MBS. It's squarely focused on the West. The West is focused so much dispersed all over at the moment. So as at the endowment and the commitment that you have for the people of Afghanistan, given the support that you give to all the people, how would you be able to help them to keep the country relevant to policymakers.
The agency isn't all on the West here. Policymakers often in democratic countries can only lean in if there's something to support.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of the endowment's role is to support those Afghans that really do want to provide something for democratic actors to support. You know, think about the difference in Ukraine. If Zelensky had left Kabul, if the Ukrainian army hadn't stood up, if the Ukrainian people hadn't resisted, Western resolve to support Ukraine wouldn't be there. Mm-hmm. Western resolve to support Ukraine outpaced the public, outpaced our politicians, because publics in Europe and the United States, Canada, saw what average Ukrainians were doing. Extraordinary. Ukrainian flags pop up everywhere. And now politicians and policymakers see we have something to support.
Yeah.
And so the issue is agency. The answer is the agency of Afghans. There has to be something to support. And so our job isn't to be the advocacy agency for Afghans. Our job is not to necessarily make that case.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, in my own private conversations and the way we engage on Capitol Hill and with others, we talk about Afghanistan. But what our job is to support those Afghans who can show up at the Geneva Human Rights Council, that can show up in debates and congressional briefings, that can show up in public debates and help show policymakers, political actors, publics, that there's something to support, that there are women organized groups that deserve backing, that there are incredible media outlets doing remarkable work that deserve that oxygen.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's not to misplace the agency on the United States or the United Kingdom or others to now write the next chapter for Afghanistan. But how can we empower Afghans that we don't even know their names today, probably, that are going to be writing the next chapter for Afghanistan's future? And so that's the opportunity we look for. And so that's why we support independent media, groups that want to document, hold the Taliban accountable for their actions in Afghanistan. Those that are very much part of the advocacy movements, whether it's at UN bodies or in capitals and in key countries, whether it's part of our Democrats at Risk and helping scholars at risk to really have a platform in which they can stay relevant to the future. So these are the types of investments we make so that people understand that there's something to support.
Yeah.
And that's the key here. And so much of the debate on Afghanistan was, corrupt government, what do we support? They're not willing to fight for themselves. We have to we are going to support those Afghans that can say, challenge that and say, no, we are organized in a way that we offer attractive organizations, people, groups to back. And mm-hmm. we are going to be the future of Afghanistan. And I think that's going to take some time. But if you were doing this from a cold calculated, cost calculation or risk calculation, that's why most donors won't do this. They'll walk away. This is complicated. It takes time. It's long term. And that's where we come in, because we're going to be in it for the long haul.
There's this concern among many in the diaspora and also the people who are in Afghanistan, is that when it comes to being able to grab attention and have access to resources to make a difference, it's always the people who've had pre-existing networks, who usually are people who've done so much harm. By that, I mean the old guard. And you're in contact with a lot of people in a much deeper level than I'd ever be. What I'm asking is, do you sense that moment of the process of transition from one generation to the next? We've had a tired group of leaders who left Afghanistan in so much disgrace. I think we've not had, and I think one of the issues has been that from the people of Afghanistan's point of view, they have not had that moment to be able to hold the people who actually brought that on them accountable.
That's right.
In America, at least you have some sense of accountability. Afghanistan has become a partisan, at least an issue of political football or whatever you call it. In Europe and in Canada, at least wrongdoings are being investigated. But for the people of Afghanistan, they can see it. You know, all these men with their dollars, with their homes in sunny beaches and enjoying their lives while the people suffer. I'm trying to get your take on that, because these people have not had their moment to hold the people accountable.
I hear you. And we see this oftentimes, that there are sometimes people with names, relationships, recognition, money, that can dominate the public debate, some of the political access. NED tends to put its investment on grassroots organizations, on support for emerging leaders, placing a bet on the next generation, empowering sometimes the voiceless, so that it is grounded, authentic in communities that can enjoy that backing and support at home. And so you think about what's happening in Iran today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not led by the people who, all the names that were known in the West. That's just not the case. And so I think that's our approach, is to think about, we're not going to abandon partners that were forced to flee for their safety and security. We want to stand by them to see if they can figure out a way to be relevant to the people in Afghanistan today. But that'll be a sorting process as people come to their own conclusions about what they can, can't do. Because all of that focus, all of our focus needs to be on helping support groups, helping to support the people inside Afghanistan, where they have a chance to shape their future. And that's why oftentimes NED partners, you know, if you look at the NED portfolio, we probably have almost 17, 18 Nobel Peace Prize winners, or that are former NED partners affiliated with the endowment. But they never began that way. Most of them began unknown. And so it's partly why the NED staff is often from these countries, speaks the languages, is ethnically diverse itself, because our role is to really have a deep understanding, not a superficial understanding and know only people with names and reputations, but a really deeper understanding of the dynamics inside countries, and that we can find up-and-coming groups because we're flexible, because we're nimble, because we can take risks, to be able to take a bet on a young student group. And I see this all the time. You know, if you look at Nigeria, I was in Nigeria a few months ago before their election, and Yagra Africa has become an incredible youth-led organization that really played the key role in doing parallel vote tabulation, helping to play a key role in the election process there. And it began as a group of students at a university at a regional city that we took a bet on 20 years ago. And I think that's the thing that is important to think about, that the next chapter of Afghanistan's future will probably be led by people that we don't know their names today.
Mm-hmm.
But I hope that they are folks that we can see a spark, help invest in, stand by them in their own journey, and be surprised when we see, or maybe not so surprised, when we see a new crop of leaders leading a different type of struggle that leads to more sustainable outcomes.
Damon, what I see from your line of thinking is it's very clear. You've come to terms with what happened. You've accepted the reality of what's really happening to the people of Afghanistan, and now you're looking forward. I reacted in a certain way when things happened, and now I'm determined to help the people of Afghanistan in the long term. We cannot change the reality of what happened in the past. We cannot cry over it all day. So we have to move on. And this is what I get from you, which is interesting and which is quite inspiring. But me in the UK, you in Washington, and we have our listeners in Afghanistan as well, and that generation of young men and women, many of them can speak English and they're listening to us. They'll be writing to us. They'll be sending the messages. Suppose there's somebody, there's a teenage girl in Bamyan or a teenage boy in Mazar-e-Sharif. They're listening to this. What Damon Wilson has for them, what would your work mean to them, that you'd be thinking of them doing the things that you hope will make their lives a bit of difference, but also empower them to be able to bring about that change that they want in their lives? And maybe one day some of them would aspire to be sitting on that very chair that you're sitting.
That's right. I hope there is a young woman in Bamyan listening, or a young boy in Mazar, or someone in Herat, someone in Kandahar. And I want them to know that they are seen, that we do believe in them, and to understand that we, outsiders, the West, Americans, even for that matter, the Afghan diaspora, isn't going to be puppet masters to determine their future. The only way things really will change is when they have that sense of possibility, a sense of agency, confidence in themselves, recognizing the circumstances they're in, the challenges, the security, all of that, figure out how they are going to have a say in not only their own future, but shaping the future of their community. And when people see that resolve, that determination, those principles, we're going to be there to help support that. We're not there to determine it, to pick and choose, but it's going to be that young woman in Bamiyan who is not satisfied with her situation, that by connecting with others, by connecting with the young boy in Mazar, by working within the space that they're afforded, by figuring out how to push to expand that civic space, that they're going to be the ones that help forge that. And I want them to know that they will be seen, heard, that we believe in them. And it's not meant to be, again, naive, but it's meant to recognize that their script, their future, is not going to be written in London or Washington. I think it has to be written in Afghanistan. And that's where we have to have the confidence and the staying power to be supportive of those who really do believe in an Afghanistan where people, where girls can go to school, people can work in their own to earn money for their family, to live in dignity, can work across the country to support a unified sense of community and identity, and to help restore the habits and the democratic practices, which won't be forgotten muscle movements, but understanding that it's going to have to be different in this next chapter. And there's some young girl in Afghanistan who's going to be part of making that happen. And we want her to know we hear her, we see her, and we're going to be there to support her. But she's going to have to make the tough decisions. She's going to have to decide what she can and can't do. And we're going to be inspired by that. And hopefully others will then be inspired by that and come back to understanding we don't have to live with the moral stain of what happened in Afghanistan. We can invite a lot of people around the world to stand by that young girl going forward.
And you mentioned the civic space, using the civic space to organize, to keep the optimism going. But that civic space is shrinking by the day, especially if you're a woman. And what can NED do with its state partners and international partners to ensure that information gets out of the country and information flows into the country?
Right.
Because the Taliban does not yet have the means to curtail blackout internet. And I suppose that there'd be moving heaven on earth to get that gear from China or wherever they want to get. But of course, the other issue that we didn't have in the 1990s, of course, we have a generation of young, talented, educated people across the country. But what we do not have is an isolated Taliban. They're a regional actor in themselves. They've got the Chinese involved, the regional countries involved. So how can they hope to circumvent this situation and hope for a better future, as you say?
Well, you started with the right point, that access to information is one of the most fundamental building blocks, because if people are going to be able to help determine their own future, they need the ability to understand the context, the environment. They need the ability for critical thinking. It's just a fundamental ingredient to democratic practice, a free society, to those habits. And so we are, I would say, I don't want to say over-indexed, but make significant investments in independent media, particularly hybrid media that has a role to play inside the country with the talent that's outside the country, whether it's remarkable journalists that we see at Etilat Raz, or it's the new satellite broadcasting of AMU TV. I mean, there are world-class journalists from Afghanistan that continue to work with talent in the country to ensure that Afghans have access to information about their own country, what is happening. And I think that's really important as a baseline, because you'll see this in North Korea and other places in Tibet. The effort to cut off access to information is so profoundly priority among autocratic regimes, because they understand that that is what opens people's minds. Mm-hmm. And so access to information related to education, related to opportunities for women and girls to actually be able to study and be exposed to ideas, these are the fundamental building blocks that need to be part of the fabric. And so supporting that is really a priority for the endowment. And we don't create these things. Part of what we do is we get to be totally impressed by the ingenuity, the creativity, and the determination of Afghans themselves, who have the self-awareness, the talent that's outside of the country, understands that if their talent isn't used for those inside the country, it's not going to be relevant for a long time to Afghanistan's future.
And the endowment, as you've said, has shown and demonstrated its commitment to the people of Afghanistan for the long haul. Now, it cannot be done by NED alone. We at Kabulcast are telling Afghanistan stories to the world, not the world's story to the people of Afghanistan. So what I wanted to ask is that, what are you doing with your partners to make sure that they stay the course with you? I ideally want many NEDs to work together. You're in America. I want organizations, your partners, to do the same in Britain, the same in Europe, in Canada. Is there a network of NEDs, I suppose, sister organizations to continue the work and join forces with you in order to sustain that level of support that the people of Afghanistan, as you just mentioned, need?
Right. You know, look, one of the big roles that we play, I think of NED as venture capital for democracy, because we're going to be in it. We're going to take some risks, and it's going to be harder for other donors, private foundations, government donors. Many people are focused on what's the impact, what's the result, what are the outcomes that we can feel in a measurable sort of near-term time frame. And that's really difficult in the context of Afghanistan today. So the way I see NED being catalytic, because we're not, you know, we don't have billions of dollars to throw at this. We don't. Afghanistan is one of our largest programs, but in the grand scheme of things, it's still a modest amount of money. But what we can show is success. Success begets success. And so if we can show that, look, this group has made the transition well, this group is effective inside the country, this group has a strong network of working in exile and working with those inside the country, it builds confidence in the ability of those groups to go to other donors and say, we have proof of concept. NED has supported us at the riskiest phase of potential failure. Some of these will fail. And I'm prepared for that. I'm prepared for us to be venture capital and take some of those risks. But what it does is it builds a baseline for support. Because people want something to support. And now some of these organizations can go to other donors and show, let me show you what we have done since the fall of Kabul, the fall of Afghanistan under the Taliban, what we've been able to do with this modest NED support. We are able to prove our relevance still. And now that should be able to help entice more donors to come to the table. We can do that directly in some of the conversations we have with other donors, but we also empower Afghans themselves to make better cases and pitches to other international support. And we've seen this in country after country, where we will take some initial risk, take Russian media, right after a lot of Russian media thrown out of Russia. The endowment was there immediately to support them in that transition. And over time, in a way that we couldn't sustain financially, but we could show other donors, look how quickly they've been able to reestablish, be effective, retain their audiences, have impact in the country. Now it's time for you to step in and pick up some of the slack and really expand the pool of resources available. And that's why people want something to support. So if our venture capital can help Afghans show, I'm here, we're effective, there is something to support, I think that's part of the way of rebuilding a sense of solidarity, of rebuilding a stronger international financial commitment to Afghanistan's future, not just to its humanitarian situation.
Do you think the right lessons are being learned about Afghanistan?
You know, I think that's going to take time. I think it I think the most important lessons, and probably the people who will get there first, will be Afghans, because they will have an urgency of ownership to get there. It's tough, a lot of recriminations, accountability, finger pointing, it's tough. And you see some of that percolating among the diaspora already. But I think to think about, what's the next chapter going to look like? How is it going to be more sustainable? How will that next chapter be written by Afghanistan's? There's a real imperative for Afghans to go through that process themselves and to lead that. I think the reckoning for many on the outside, many in democratic countries in the West, I think that will take time. I think that will be part of churning through owning this, not through the immediate political recriminations. I mean, there's something to be said for that. But I think it's going to take a little bit more time for people to understand and appreciate and factor that in. I think you have seen some painful lessons that perhaps the way the United States and its partners withdrew from Afghanistan, could that have emboldened Vladimir Putin and his thinking about Ukraine? And there's a tendency to want to say, and you hear it in Ukraine today, why are we spending all of this in Ukraine? We need to be focused on Taiwan. It's not really how the world works. Mm-hmm. Folks, we're in a globalized world. People watch to test, to understand, resolve. And I think there's an appreciation that Afghanistan may have had some difficult consequences. And Ukraine, unfortunately, has had to pay a price.
Yeah.
And ironically, is a bit of a beneficiary in the rallying of Western solidarity. So this is going to be a complex process. We're going to rely on historians as well.
Yeah.
It's going to be iterative. But what I hope is that Afghans lead the process first, because if they get there first and understanding what went wrong, how do we think about this? What are the lessons? It's going to empower them to shape the next chapter and inspire more people outside the country to rally by their side.
Thank you so much, Damon. I think we're getting into... I'm working the title for this podcast in my head, Let's Empower the People of Afghanistan to Bring About Their Own Change.
That's right. Ultimately, that's what democracy is about. Empowering people to have a say over their own future, to change their future for the better. It's pretty simple, and yet it's awesome in its power, and it's awesome in why, and as you see over and over again, despite culture, despite historical differences, it's a universal yearning. And I have confidence that that's an opportunity.
But there's also this realistic concern among the people of Afghanistan, the people that we talk to, is the level of increased engagement with the Taliban, which enables it to become normalized, a normalized actor in the region and the world. And that is path to recognition for many, a quasi-recognition, I suppose, for a lot of people. And statements like the ones that President Biden made, those kind of statements welcomed by the Taliban, and they're concerned, they worry the people. Words matter. Statements do count. The worry is that the more these engagements increase, longer the Taliban's rule will become, and the more normalized they will be. What is your response to that?
Look, first of all, a regime that pursues gender apartheid cannot be normalized in the 21st century. Can't. And I think there will be a lot of moral opprobrium from publics, from interest groups. And ultimately, because we are democracies, this influx of Afghans in so many countries ultimately will become constituency groups in these countries that will hold our politicians accountable, as you have talked about in the United Kingdom. And I think that's powerful, because we should be responsive to our people. And the American people, the British people, gender apartheid, it's not okay.
You never. I mean, when we met in Washington, there was Ilyas's baby was there. You know, in that room.
Yes,
there are so many babies in America now, born of American babies. I suppose
these are future voters, future presidents.
You know,
future presidents,
and exactly
that is right. I have to say, Ro, it's one of the tragedies is to see such amazing talent have to leave Afghanistan. But there is an incredible boon for the United States, for my country, to be enriched by this community that is here. And it will, I mean, Afghanistan will be woven into the United States forever now.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what gives me confidence, because it's been a blow to Afghanistan to lose this human capital today. But over the long term, it will really ensure that the bonds between our countries are inseparable and strong. And I think over time, that will be a really powerful force to support the democratic aspirations, the freedoms of Afghan boys and girls, men and women. And so
now you're really thinking long term, don't you?
It's long term. Look, we're approaching year 40 of our programming in Afghanistan. So I don't want to have to wait another 40 years, but we do come to it. It's partly the beauty of the endowment to mm-hmm. be built outside of the U.S. government, beyond administrations, yeah. beyond political cycles, so that we can have a long-term approach that isn't subject to the vagaries of a political cycle. And I think that means that we have the privilege and honor of representing the best of the values of the American people with a degree of consistency, focused laser-like on our mission, which is only democracy and freedom.
And just ask, would you run for public office one day? Could you give us a Cobblecast exclusive?
All right. Now we've gone beyond the brief. This is we're here to support the democratic aspirations of others. I am so honored to be able to play that role. I can't think of a more privileged position to be in right now. And that is my absolute focus. It's at a time, you started off by saying democracy is receding. I'm going to close by saying it's not really that in some respects. Democracy is under attack. We're in a fight, and mm-hmm. the authoritarians have learned, they've gotten smarter, they're using technology, they're empowered by the rise of China, the revanchism of Vladimir Putin, and a sense of Autocracy Inc. that backs them up. So we are in a fight, and it's why I came to the endowment, because this is a consequential moment for democracy. And I am here because we have to figure out how to work together in solidarity to stop this attack on democracy, to push back on it, and ultimately to support those on the front lines of struggles everywhere that will lead the fourth democratic wave historically. And I hope that fourth democratic wave will not overlook Afghanistan.
You're so committed into doing what you're doing. And to help Afghanistan, a major part of that promotion of democratic values. And thank you so much, Damon.
I'm really grateful for your time. It's an honor to be with you and to be with your listeners. Thank you so much.